3. I am not alone in this, as the Verge's feature fanboys reveals, anytime anybody in the universe says something negative about Microsoft, Brad Thorne loses it. He res up Twitter, "You're fucking pathetic. You have your head so far up your ass. I can't wait until you eat your smug words." Thorne, a 40-ish IT manager with a preppy wardrobe and shy grin, is actually a nice guy in person. He plays golf and enjoys spending time with his wife and stepkids. He works as an IT director at a non-profit charity organization in the South that's run by nuns. He is not religious unless you count his relationship with Microsoft, of course. "I'm a missionary," says Thorne. "For me, it's about being super passionate and super knowledgeable about their products, and not leaving that passion at the door when you leave work. You preach it all the time." Chapter 4. The Press Secretary. In your mind, the individual mandate made its political debut in a 1989 Heritage Foundation brief titled "Assuring Affordable Healthcare for All Americans," as a counterpoint to the single-payer system and the employer mandate that were favored in Democratic circles. In the brief, Stuart Butler, the conservative think tank's healthcare expert, argued, "Many states now require passengers in automobiles to wear seat belts for their own protection. Many others require anybody driving a car to have liability insurance. But neither the federal government nor any state requires all households to protect themselves from the potentially catastrophic costs of a serious accident or illness. Under the Heritage Plan, there would be such a requirement." One in 1991, Milton Friedman, the legendary conservative economist, wrote a Wall Street Journal op-ed proposing a requirement that every U.S. family unit have a major medical insurance policy. To Mark Pauly, an economist at the Wharton School, tried to persuade George H.W. Bush's administration to adopt an individual mandate because, he told me, "we were concerned about the specter of single-payer insurance, which isn't market-oriented." 3. The mandate made its RST legislative appearance in 1993. In the Health Equity and Access Reform Today Act, the Senate Republicans' alternative to President Clinton's health reform bill, which was sponsored by John Chaffee of Rhode Island and co-sponsored by 18 Republicans, including Bob Dole, who was then the Senate Minority Leader. "I was the one who came up with the idea to put it in the bill," Christine Ferguson, who directed Chaffee's health policy team in the 1990s and would go on to lead Mitt Romney's Department of Public Health in Massachusetts, told me. "The Republicans had decided we'd need to put a bill together on our own. I was hearing all kinds of conversations on the Republican side about personal responsibility and how Republicans weren't nannies, and that really resonated with me. And so I said that if our concern was we want personal responsibility, why don't we say individuals have to take it up and the cost, if it's prohibitive, should have some kind of subsidy." 4. After the Clinton bill, which called for an employer mandate, failed, Democrats came to recognize the opportunity that the Chaffee bill had presented. In the system, the American way of politics at the breaking point, Haynes Johnson and David Broder's history of the healthcare wars of the 90s, Clinton concedes that it was the best chance he had of reaching a bipartisan compromise. "It should have been right then, or the day after they presented their bill, where I should have tried to have a direct understanding with Dole," he said. 10 years later, Senator Ron Wyden, an Oregon Democrat, began picking his way back through the history. He read the system 4 times and he, too, came to focus on the Chaffee bill. He began building a proposal around the individual mandate and tested it out on both Democrats and Republicans. "Between 2004 and 2008, I saw over 80 members of the Senate, and there were very few who objected," Wyden told me. 6. In December 2006, he unveiled the Healthy Americans Act. In May 2007, Bob Bennett, a Utah Republican who had been a sponsor of the Chaffee bill, joined him. Wyden-Bennett was eventually co-sponsored by 11 Republicans and 9 Democrats, receiving more bipartisan support than any universal health care proposal in the history of the Senate. It even caught the eye of the Republican presidential aspirants. In a June 2009 interview on Meet the Press, Romney, who, as governor of Massachusetts, had signed a universal health care bill with an individual mandate, said that Wyden-Bennett was a plan that a number of Republicans think is a very good health care plan, one that we support. 7. Wyden's bill was part of a broader trend of Democrats endorsing the individual mandate in their own proposals. John Edwards and Hillary Clinton both built a mandate into their campaign health care proposals. In 2008, Senator Ted Kennedy brought John McDonough, a liberal advocate of the Massachusetts plan, to Washington to help with health care reform. That same year, Max Baucus, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, included an individual mandate in the RST draft of his health care bill. The main Democratic holdout was Senator Barack Obama. But by July 2009, President Obama had changed his mind. "I was opposed to this idea because my general attitude was the reason people don't have health insurance is not because they don't want it. It's because they can't afford it," he told CBS News. "I am now in favor of some sort of individual mandate." 8. This process led, eventually, to the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, which also included an individual mandate. The bill was designed to be a compromise proposal, and for a time, it looked like it was. In June 2009, Senator Chuck Grassley, then the top Republican on the powerful Senate Finance Committee, told Fox News, "I believe that there is a bipartisan consensus to have individual mandates." 9. And then something went wrong. In December 2009, every single Senate Republican voted for a point of order calling the individual mandate unconstitutional. Among them were Senators Bob Bennett, Lamar Alexander, Bob Corker, Mike Crapo, Lindsey Graham, Chuck Grassley, and Judd Gregg, all of whom were co-sponsors of the Healthy Americans Act, which, again, included an individual mandate. There were no revolutions in constitutional law between January 2007 and December 2009. Nor did the individual mandate show itself to be fatally odd in some particular way. Quite the opposite. In fact, it was being successfully implemented in Massachusetts as part of Romney's reforms. But there had been a political change. Democrats had gone from opposing the mandate to supporting it. This shift, Democrats lining up behind the Republican-crafted mandate, and Republicans declaring it not just inappropriate policy but contrary to the wishes of the founders, shocked Wyden. "I would characterize the Washington, D.C., relationship with the individual mandate as truly schizophrenic," he said. 10. It was not an isolated case. In 2007, both Newt Gingrich and John McCain wanted a cap-and-trade program in order to reduce carbon emissions. A few years later, the entire party, including them, turned against the idea. In 2008, the Bush administration proposed, pushed, and signed the Economic Stimulus Act, a DCIT-enhanced tax cut designed to boost the agging economy. Under Obama, Republicans became staunch opponents of the idea that DCIT-enhanced stimulus could help an economy, before re-embracing the idea under Trump. When Romney ran for president in 2012, he was mocked by Democrats for saying that Russia was America's foremost geopolitical threat, after Russia helped Trump win the 2016 presidential election. Democrats turned sharply against Russia, while Republicans came to view Vladimir Putin more favorably than they viewed Obama. 11. There's an easy explanation for this: cynicism, hypocrisy, lying. And when we see it happening in others, particularly in an out-group, that's what we assume. But I've interviewed enough politicians, activists, and pundits who have changed their position alongside their party to know that it often feels sincere, at least to them. "Hell, I've changed my mind and been accused of insincerity, or at least inconsistency. Life comes at you fast, read the gotcha tweets. But my mental processes always feel honest to me. After all, isn't changing our minds in response to new information and arguments what we're supposed to do? What separates political opportunism from intellectual growth?" Turns out the answer is, not much. We understand reasoning to be an individual act. This is, in many cases, wrong. The central awe in the concept of reason that animated the 18th century Enlightenment is that it is entirely individualistic, writes philosopher Joseph Heath. 12. But decades of research has proven that reason is both decentralized and dispersed across multiple individuals. It is not possible to be rational all by yourself, rationality is inherently a collective project. I put more simply, reasoning is something we often do in groups, in order to serve group ends. This is not a wrinkle of human irrationality, but rather a rational response to the complexity and danger of the world around us. Collectively, a group can know more and reason better than an individual, and thus human beings with the social and intellectual skills to pool knowledge had a survival advantage over those who didn't. We are their descendants. Once you understand that, the ease with which individuals, even informed individuals, IP their positions to the group's needs makes a lot more sense. Reasoning in groups in 1951, Solomon Ash, a professor at Swarthmore College, set out to study exactly how much of our reasoning we were willing to outsource to others. He showed subjects a card with a line and then asked them to match it to the line of corresponding length on another card. The test was easy. Under control conditions, fewer than 1% of the answers were wrong. 13. The twist, however, was that the subjects weren't alone. There were also seven other participants who were actually working for Ash. And every so often, they would all give the same wrong answer. These were called the critical trials. The results were remarkable. On critical trials, the participants gave the wrong answer 37% of the time. Given the choice between what their eyes were telling them and what the group was telling them, they went with the group. I felt conspicuous, going out on a limb, and subjecting myself to criticism that my perceptions, faculties were not as acute as they might be, said one of the subjects in a post-experiment interview. Ash's work, which showed the way a group can influence the opinions of an individual, has been the basis for a revolution in understanding not just how humans think, but how partisans think. Because what is a political party, after all, but a group? In 2003, Gio Ray Cohen, then an assistant professor of psychology at Yale, gave students in an introductory psychology course a survey asking them, among many other questions, to rate how liberal or conservative they were and how strongly they felt about welfare. Then, later in the term, he asked the students who had rated themselves as the most ideological and the most passionate about welfare to come in and participate in a study testing their memory of everyday current events. The participating students, who didn't know how or why they'd been chosen, were given two newspaper articles. The RST was a dummy, which served no purpose other than to reinforce the plausibility of the cover story. The second article described a proposed welfare policy. 14. In one version of the article, the policy was extremely generous, owing almost $800 per month to a family with one child, an extra $200 for every additional child, full medical insurance, $2,000 in food stamps, extra subsidies for housing and daycare, a job training program, and 2 years of paid tuition at a community college. While it limited Baney TS to 8 years, it guaranteed a job after Baney TS ended, and it reinstated aid if the family had another child. The other version of the article outlined a more Spartan policy that provided only $250 per month and $50 for each additional child. It offered only partial medical insurance, and imposed a lifetime limit of 1.5 years without the possibility of reinstating aid. In contrast to the generous policy, the stringent one provided no food stamps, housing, daycare, job training, paid work, or college tuition. The articles varied in another way, too, their group cues. In the Democrats' favor variant, the article said that 95% of House Democrats favored the policy, while only 10% of House Republicans did. It also included quotes from prominent Democrats saying that the law would lighten the financial burden on the poor and accusing Republicans of victim blaming. In the Republicans' favor version, the percentages were reversed, and there were quotes from prominent Republicans explaining that the program provides sufficient coverage, without undermining a basic work ethic and sense of personal responsibility. Participants were then asked to rate their favorability toward the program on a scale of 1 to 7. These were, remember, students with particularly intense ideologies and particularly strong feelings about welfare policy. But it didn't matter. For both liberal and conservative participants, the EECT of reference group information overrode that of policy content. If their party endorsed it, liberals supported even a harsh welfare program, and conservatives supported even a lavish one. This kind of thinking is, according to psychologists, unsurprising. Each of us can have first-hand knowledge of just a small number of topics, our jobs, our studies, our personal experiences. But as citizens and as elected officials, we are routinely asked to make judgments on issues as diverse and as complex as the Iranian nuclear program, the environmental impact of an international oil pipeline, and the likely outcomes of branding China a currency manipulator. One of the roles that political parties play is helping us navigate these decisions. In theory, we join parties because they share our values and our goals, values and goals that may have been passed on to us by the most important groups in our lives, such as our families and our communities, and we trust that their policy judgments will match the ones we would come up with if we had unlimited time to study the issues. But parties, though based on a set of principles, aren't disinterested teachers in search of truth. They're organized groups looking to increase their power. Or, as the psychologists would put it, their reasoning may be motivated by something other than accuracy. None of this, of course, describes you, dear reader. You're the kind of person who buys books like, well, this one. People who don't pay much attention to politics or know much about policy might use parties as shortcuts and be vulnerable to their deceptions. But knowledge is power, and you have the knowledge. The question is simply how to get everyone else that knowledge, too. Right? This ladders up to a broader theory for seeing American politics. I can't tell you how many times I've been cornered by someone arguing that the answer to our problems is lifelong civic education or media literacy classes. This can take more extreme forms, too. In 2016, Georgetown University political theorist Jason Brennan released a book entitled Against Democracy, in which he argued for an epistocracy, a system where the votes of the politically informed counted more than the votes of the politically naive. 15. I call this the competence principle, he said in an interview with Vox. The idea is that anyone or any deliberative body that exercises power over anyone else has an obligation to use that power in good faith, and has the obligation to use that power competently. If they're not going to use it in good faith, and they're not going to use it competently, that's a claim against them having any kind of authority or any kind of legitimacy. 16. We might call this the more information hypothesis. In its less aggressive manifestation, it sits hopefully at the base of almost every speech, every op-ed, every article, and every panel discussion. It courses through the Constitution and the Federalist Papers, through the philosophies of Thomas Dewey and the basic theory of high school government classes. It's the belief that many of our most bitter political battles, and most of our worst political thinking, are mere misunderstandings. The cause of these misunderstandings? Too little information, be it about climate change, taxes, Iraq, the budget deficit, or immigration. If only the citizenry were more informed, the thinking goes, then there wouldn't be all this kting. It's a seductive model. It suggests our fellow countrymen aren't wrong so much as they're misguided, ignorant, or most appealingly deceived by scoundrels from the other party. It holds that our debates are tractable and that the answers to our toughest problems aren't very controversial at all. The theory is particularly prevalent in Washington, where partisans devote enormous amounts of energy to persuading each other that there is a right answer to the difficult questions in American politics and that they have it. The only problem is it's wrong. How Politics Makes Smart People Stupid. In April and May 2013, Yale Law professor Dan Kahan, working with co-authors Ellen Peters, Erica Cantrell Dawson, and Paul Slavik, set out to test a question that consistently puzzles scientists: why isn't good data more effective in resolving political debates? For instance, why doesn't the overwhelming evidence that climate change is a real threat persuade more skeptics? The leading theory, Kahan and his co-authors wrote, is the science comprehension thesis, which says the problem is that the public doesn't know enough about science to judge the debate. 17. It's a version of the more information hypothesis. A smarter, better educated citizenry wouldn't have all these problems reading the science and accepting its clear conclusion on climate change. But Kahan and his team had an alternative hypothesis. Perhaps people aren't held back by a lack of knowledge. After all, they don't typically doubt the endings of oceanographers or the existence of other galaxies. Perhaps there are some kinds of debates where people don't want to ND the right answer so much as they want to win the argument. Perhaps humans reason for purposes other than ending the truth purposes like increasing their standing in their community or ensuring they don't ND themselves exiled by the leaders of their tribe. If this hypothesis proved true, then a smarter, better educated citizenry wouldn't put an end to these disagreements. It would just mean the participants are better equipped to argue for their own side. Kahan and his team came up with a clever way to test which theory was right. They took 1,000 Americans, surveyed their political views, and then gave them a standard test used for assessing math skills. Then they presented them with a brain teaser. In its initial form, the brain teaser was a tricky math problem about how well a skin cream worked. It was designed to deceive you on RST glance. If you didn't carefully run the numbers, or didn't have the statistical aptitude needed to run the numbers, you'd get it wrong. As expected, the better subjects were at math, the better they were at the brain teaser. This was true for both liberals and conservatives. Score 1 for the science comprehension thesis. But Kahan and his co-authors also drafted a politicized version of the problem, which used the same numbers as the skin cream question, but instead of being about skin creams, the narrative setup focused on a proposal to ban people from carrying concealed handguns in public. The question now compared crime data in the cities that banned handguns against crime data in the cities that didn't. Presented with this problem, a funny thing happened. How good subjects were at math stopped predicting how well they did on the test. Now it was ideology that drove the answers. Liberals were extremely good at solving the problem when doing so proved that gun control legislation reduced crime. But when presented with the version of the problem that suggested gun control had failed, their math skills stopped mattering. They tended to get the problem wrong no matter how good they were at math. Conservatives exhibited the same pattern just in reverse. Being better at math didn't just fail to help partisans converge on the right answer. It actually drove them further apart. Among those with weak math skills, subjects were 25 percentage points likelier to get the answer right when it bolstered their ideology. But partisans with strong math skills were 45 percentage points likelier to get the answer right when it T their ideology. The smarter the person is, the dumber politics can make them. 218 I want to dwell on this for a minute, because it's an insane ending. Being better at math made partisans less likely to solve the problem correctly when solving the problem correctly meant betraying their political instincts. People weren't reasoning to get the right answer, they were reasoning to get the answer that they wanted to be right. The skin cream experiment wasn't the RST time. Kahan had shown that partisanship has a way of short-circuiting intelligence. In another study, he tested people's science literacy alongside their ideology and then asked about the risks posed by climate change. If the problem was truly that people needed to know more about science to fully appreciate the dangers of a warming climate, then their concern should have risen alongside their knowledge. But here, too, the opposite was true. Among people who were already skeptical of climate change, science literacy made them more skeptical of climate change. 19 This will resonate with anyone who's ever read the work of a serious climate change denialist. It's LLED with facts and GERS, graphs and charts, studies and citations. Much of the data is wrong or irrelevant. But it feels convincing. It's a Terry C. performance of science inquiry. And climate change skeptics who immerse themselves in researching counter-arguments end up far more content that global warming is a hoax than people who haven't spent much time studying the issue. This is true for all kinds of things, of course. Ever argued with a 9/11 truther? I have, and they are quite informed about the various melting points of steel. More information can help us ND the right answers. But if our search is motivated by aims other than accuracy, more information can mislead us or, more precisely, help us mislead ourselves. There's a difference between searching for the best evidence and searching for the best evidence that proves us right. And in the age of the internet, such evidence and such experts are never very far away. In another experiment, Kahan and his co-authors gave out sample biographies of highly accomplished scientists alongside a summary of the results of their research. Then they asked whether the scientist was indeed an expert on the issue. It turned out that on highly politicized issues, people's actual definition of expert is a credentialed person who agrees with me. For instance, when the researchers' results underscored the dangers of climate change, people who worry about climate change were 72 percentage points more likely to agree that the researcher was a bona fide expert. When the same researcher with the same credentials was attached to results that cast doubt on the dangers of global warming, people who tended to dismiss climate change were 54 percentage points more likely to see the researcher as an expert. 20. What's striking here is that the EX are strongest among the voters who pay the closest attention to the issues. In a 2006 paper, "It Feels Like We're Thinking," the political scientists Christopher Aiken and Larry Bartels looked at an American national election study, a poll supported by the National Science Foundation, from 1996. One of the questions asked whether the size of the yearly budget to CIT increased, decreased, or stayed about the same during Clinton's time as president. The correct answer is that it decreased dramatically. Here, again, more information led to more self-deception. Aiken and Bartels categorized the respondents according to how politically informed they were. Among the least informed respondents, Democrats and Republicans picked the wrong answer in roughly equal numbers. But among better informed voters, the story was different. Republicans who were in the 50th percentile gave the right answer more often than those in the 90th percentile. 21. Bartels found a similar EECT in a 1988 survey, in which a majority of respondents who described themselves as strong Democrats said that a nation had gotten worse over the 8 years of the Reagan administration. In fact, it had fallen from 13.5% in 1980 to 4.1% in 1988. 22. If you were a lightly informed Republican in the Clinton years or Democrat in the Reagan years, you knew you didn't like the president, and you knew the economy was pretty good. But if you were deep in the partisan literature of the Reagan era, you knew people thought the economy was good, but were they paying attention to the budget to CIT? Did they realize the tax cuts were going straight to the rich? So, too, in the Clinton era, elite Republicans could tell you quite a lot about the trade to CIT with China or the credit bubble keeping the economy aloft. At any given moment, there are a lot of facts out there and a lot of smart people airing them to you in different configurations. Even among unusually well-informed and politically engaged people, the political preferences and judgments that look and feel like the basis of partisanship and voting behavior are, in reality, often consequences of party and group loyalties, write Aiken and Bartels in their book Democracy for Realists, Why Elections Do Not Produce Responsive Government. In fact, the more information the voter has, often the better able she is to bolster her identities with rational-sounding reasons. 23. Kahan is quick to note that, most of the time, people are perfectly capable of being convinced by the best evidence. There's a lot of disagreement about climate change and gun control, for instance, but almost none over whether antibiotics work, or whether the H1N1U is a problem, or whether heavy drinking impairs people's ability to drive. Rather, our reasoning becomes rationalizing when we're dealing with questions where the answers could threaten our group or at least our social standing in our group. And in those cases, Kahan says, we're being perfectly rational when we fool ourselves. Imagine what would happen to, say, Sean Hannity if he decided tomorrow that climate change was the central threat facing the planet. Initially, his viewers would think he was joking. But soon, they'd begin calling in furiously. Some would organize a boycott of his program. Dozens, perhaps hundreds of professional climate skeptics would begin angrily refuting Hannity's new crusade. Many of Hannity's friends in the conservative media world would back away from him, and some would seek advantage by denouncing him. Politicians he respects would be furious at his betrayal of the cause. He would lose friendships, viewers, and money. He could ultimately lose his job. And along the way he would cause himself immense personal pain as he systematically alienated his closest political and professional allies. The world would have to update its understanding of who Sean Hannity is and what he believes, and so, too, with Sean Hannity. Changing your identity is a psychologically and socially brutal process. Kahan doesn't ND. It's strange that we react to threatening information by mobilizing our intellectual artillery to destroy it. He thinks it's strange that we would expect rational people to do anything else. Nothing any ordinary member of the public personally believes about the existence, causes, or likely consequences of global warming will accept the risk that climate change poses to her, or to anyone or anything she cares about, Kahan writes. However, if she forms the wrong position on climate change relative to the one held by people with whom she has a close affinity and on whose high regard and support she depends on in myriad ways in her daily life, she could suffer extremely unpleasant consequences, from shunning to the loss of employment. The reality, he concludes, is that the cost to her of making a mistake on the science is zero, but the cost of being out of sync with her peers potentially catastrophic, making it individually rational to put group dynamics RST when thinking about issues like climate change. Point 24 Kahan calls this theory identity protective cognition, as a way of avoiding dissonance and estrangement from valued groups. Individuals subconsciously resist factual information that threatens their denying values. Elsewhere, he puts it even more pithily, what we believe about the facts, he writes, tells us who we are. And the most important psychological imperative most of us have in a given day is protecting our idea of who we are and our relationships with the people we trust and love. Anyone who has ever found themselves in an angry argument with their political or social circle will know how threatening it feels. For a lot of people, being right just isn't worth picking a bitter GHT with the people they care about. That's particularly true in a place like Washington, where social circles and professional lives are often organized around people's politics, and the boundaries of what those tribes believe are getting sharper. In an interview I did with David Brooks in 2019, the genuinely conservative New York Times columnist reacted on the social agony criticizing Trump had caused him. I had been part of the conservative movement my whole life, he told me. The Weekly Standard, The Wall Street Journal, National Review, Washington Times. Suddenly, I wasn't the kind of conservative all the other conservatives were, and so my social circles drifted away. Brooks was living alone at the time, and the consequences, for his life, were painful. My weekends were just howling silences, he says. Point 25 You can think of Washington as a machine for making identity protective cognition easier. Each party has its allied think tanks, go-to experts, favored magazines, friendly blogs, sympathetic pundits, determined activists, and ideological moneymen. Both the professionals and the committed volunteers who make up the party machinery are members of social circles, Twitter worlds, Facebook groups, workplaces, and many other ecosystems that would make life very unpleasant for them if they strayed too far from the faith. And these institutions end up employing a lot of very smart, very sincere people whose formidable intelligence makes certain that they typically stay in line. To do anything else would upend their day-to-day lives. What's worse is that it never feels cynical, it never reads as rationalization. It always, always feels like our honest search for the truth has led us to the answer that con RMS our priors. The problem, of course, is that these people are also acting, and in some cases controlling, the levers of government. The Mandates Day in court on March 23, 2010, the day that President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act into law, 14 state attorneys general led suit against the law's requirement that most Americans purchase health insurance, on the ground that it was unconstitutional. At the time, it was hard to ND a law professor in the country who took them seriously. The argument about constitutionality is, if not frivolous, close to it, Sanford Levinson, a University of Texas law school professor, told McClatchy. Erwin Kimerinsky, then the dean of the law school at the University of California at Irvine, told The Times, there is no case law, post-1937, that would support an individual's right not to buy health care if the government wants to mandate it. Orrin Kerr, then a George Washington University professor who had clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy, said, there is a less than 1% chance that the courts will invalidate the individual mandate. 26 These expert assessments were wrong. Republican-appointed judges repeatedly ruled against the mandate, even as judges appointed by Democrats repeatedly ruled in its favor. By the time the case was before the Supreme Court, Kerr told me the chances that the court would overturn the mandate was about FTY. In the end, the mandate survived on a split the D'Arens decision. Chief Justice John Roberts gave Republicans some comfort by accepting their argument that the mandate was not justified under the federal government's power to regulate interstate commerce, a ruling that expanded the kinds of cases they could bring to the court in the future by narrowing one of the federal government's broadest powers. But he decided the penalty was a tax, and the government's taxation power was broad, so he joined with Kennedy and the court's liberals to uphold it. Point 3. This preserved the policy, but it convinced no one of the mandate's constitutionality. Roberts was George W. Bush's choice to lead the court. He was a former Reagan staffer. But the conservative movement didn't take those credentials as reason to listen to him, to revise their views and see the mandate as cleanly constitutional. It took them as reason to feel betrayed by him. "Why are Republicans so awful at picking Supreme Court justices?" lamented Mark Thiessen, a former Bush speechwriter, in the Washington Post. "Democrats have been virtually lawless in appointing reliable liberals to the court. Yet Republicans, more often than not, appoint justices who vote with the other side on critical decisions." 27. What the Obamacare case did convince many of was the waning legitimacy of the Supreme Court. The near success of what seemed like a ridiculous argument to liberals persuaded them of the judiciary's increasing politicization. Conservatives, meanwhile, suspected Kennedy and Roberts of motivated reasoning on behalf of the court itself. They knew it would have been institutionally disastrous for the court to overturn Obamacare, so they found an excuse to back down. "And while I obviously ND one of those arguments more persuasive than the other, I can't tell you that's not just my motivated reasoning in action." Jonathan Haidt, a professor of psychology at New York University's Business School, sees the role that individual reason plays in political arguments as akin to the job of the White House press secretary. In his book The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, he writes, "No matter how bad the policy, the secretary will ND some way to praise or defend it. Sometimes you'll hear an awkward pause as the secretary searches for the right words, but what you'll never hear is, 'Hey, that's a great point. Maybe we should rethink this policy.'" Press secretaries can't say that because they have no power to make or revise policy. They're told what the policy is, and their job is to ND evidence and arguments that will justify the policy to the public. Point 28. For that reason, Haidt told me, once group loyalties are engaged, you can't change people's minds by utterly refuting their arguments. Thinking is mostly just rationalization, mostly just a search for supporting evidence. 29. Psychologists have a term for this, motivated reasoning. Just as a press secretary is motivated to defend his or her boss's positions, so, too, is our mind motivated to defend our group's positions or the conclusion we need to reach for other reasons. To spend much time with this research is to stare into a kind of intellectual abyss. If the work of gathering evidence and reasoning through thorny, polarizing political questions is actually the process by which we trick ourselves into ending the answers we want, then what's the right way to search for answers? How can we know the answers we come up with, no matter how well-intentioned, aren't just more motivated cognition? How can we know the experts we're relying on haven't subtly biased their answers, too? How can I know that this book isn't a form of identity protection? Kahan's research tells us we can't trust our own reason. How do we reason our way out of that? IRST wrote about motivated reasoning and Obamacare's individual mandate in 2012. In response to that piece, the psychologist Paul Bloom wrote an article in The Atlantic that didn't quarrel with anything in my argument but included this gotcha. Notice that Klein doesn't reach for a social psychology journal when articulating why he and his Democratic allies are so content that Obamacare is constitutional. 30. Bloom's right, of course. But the implications are more radical than he seemed prepared to admit. The question isn't whether I fall victim to motivated reasoning, too, or whether I'm less psychically guarded when faced with information that accords with my values and worldview. Of course I am. The question is what it means that all of us are doing this, to greater or lesser degrees, all the time. There are mysteries in life that have testable, knowable answers. Do antibiotics clear strep throat? Does iodine make river water safe to drink? Magnets, how do they work? But there are plenty that don't. Constitutional interpretation is one of them. The founding fathers themselves de-erred on what the Constitution meant and permitted, not to mention how such questions should be decided. Thomas J. E. Ayerson, for instance, believed every branch of government should be permitted to interpret the Constitution for itself. He lost that ght, and the Supreme Court was given ultimate authority over constitutional arbitration. But the Supreme Court itself is just 9 robed judges and, increasingly, 9 robed judges who are chosen not just for their brilliance but for their ideological reliability, more on that later. The court isn't meant to be political, but the cases it faces are often political, and the process by which a judge is nominated and confirmed is thoroughly politicized. The EDICE of constitutional interpretation and the legitimacy we give it is that there is a right answer to a question like, is the individual mandate constitutional? But perhaps there isn't. And even if there is one answer, there's no particular reason to believe a handful of extremely adept debaters, all of whom distinguished themselves for the job by persuading politicians of their ideological reliability, would end it, or that the rest of us would care if they did. You can see what I mean when I say that taking this literature too seriously can feel like staring into the abyss. My whole career and much of politics more generally is based on the idea that gathering good information helps us understand hard policy issues and that putting the two together can change minds and lead to a better world. But once our political identities and interests push themselves in front of our cognition, that model of reasoning falls to pieces. Kahan's work suggests that cognition exists on a spectrum, ranging from issues where the truth matters and our identities don't to issues where our identities dominate and the truth fades in importance. One implication of an era where our political identities are becoming more sordid and more powerful is that it will bring with it a rise in identity protective cognition, and that's particularly true if the relevant identity groups are able to construct sophisticated architectures of information that we can use to power our reasoning. But it's also worth focusing on the word protective. As Kahan's term suggests, our reasoning is most vulnerable when our identities are most threatened. And for many, this is an era of profound threat. IIND that people often react defensively to critiques of human reasoning faculties. This seems unreasonable. As Heath argues in the book, the fact that we are not perfectly rational, the fact that our capacities for rationality seem to have evolved as a byproduct of other capabilities, like language, underscores how precious the ability to reason is and how attentive we must be to its development. Mapping its boundaries so we can consciously remain within its jurisdiction is part of how we respect this gift, not a dismissal of it. To this effect isn't limited to math, by the way. In their 1991 study Everyday Reasoning and the Roots of Intelligence, David Perkins, Michael Faraday, and Barbara Bushy brought students of different ages and intelligence levels into a lab and asked them their opinion on a complex social issue. Then they asked them to list all the arguments, on both sides of the issue, they could think of. IQ was the single largest predictor of how many arguments people listed, but it correlated only to how many supporting arguments they listed. People invest their IQ in buttressing their own case rather than in exploring the entire issue more fully and even-handedly, the researchers concluded. 3. I should note that this GHT is ongoing. Republicans subsequently took Congress, failed to repeal Obamacare, but changed the law so the mandate's penalty was $0. Then, a group of Republican attorneys general launched the Texas v. Azar case, which argues that the mandate can't be a tax if it doesn't raise any money, which makes the mandate unconstitutional, and if the mandate is unconstitutional, the Supreme Court should declare the entire law unconstitutional. Texas Judge Reed O'Connor, a former Senate GOP aide, ruled in their favor, though the case is now being appealed. If you were ever tempted to think that right-wing judges weren't activists, that they were only enforcing the Constitution or reading the statute, this will persuade you to knock it off, wrote law professor Nicholas Bagley. Chapter 5 Demographic Threat in 2008, Barack Obama held up change as a beacon, attaching to it another word that channeled everything his young and diverse coalition saw in his rise and their newfound political power, hope. An America that would elect a black man president was an America in which a future was being written that would read thrillingly different from our past. In 2016, Donald Trump wielded that same sense of change as a threat. He was the revanchist voice of those who yearned to make America the way it was before, to make it great again. That was the impulse that connected the wall to keep Mexicans out, the ban to keep Muslims away, the birtherism meant to prove Obama couldn't possibly be a legitimate president. An America that would elect Trump president was an America in which a future was being written that could read thrillingly similar to our past. This is the core cleavage of our politics, and it re-exiting trend of our era. America is changing, and fast. According to the Census Bureau, 2013 marked the rest year that a majority of U.S. infants under the age of 1 were non-white. 1. The announcement, made during the second term of the nation's RST African American president, was not a surprise. Demographers had been predicting such a tipping point for years, and they foresaw more to come. The government predicts that in 2030, immigration will overtake new births as the dominant driver of population growth. About 15 years after that, America will phase into majority-minority status for the RST time in the nation's history. Non-Hispanic whites will no longer make up a majority of the population. 2. That cross will come in part because America's black, Hispanic, Asian, and mixed-race populations are expected to grow indeed. The Hispanic and Asian populations are expected to roughly double by 2060 and the mixed-race population to triple. Meanwhile, the non-Hispanic white population is, uniquely, expected to fall, dipping from 199 million in 2020 to 179 million in 2060. The Census Bureau minces no words here. The only group projected to shrink is the non-Hispanic white population. 3. This isn't just a statement about the future. It's a description of the present. The economist Jed Kalko notes that the most common age for white Americans is 58, for Asians it's 29, for African Americans it's 27, and for Hispanics it's 11.4. A report out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Applied Population Lab found that white births are now outnumbered by white deaths in 26 states, up from 17 in 2014 and 4 in 2004.5. Meanwhile, America's foreign-born population is projected to rise from 14% of the population today to 17% in 2060, more than 2 percentage points above the record set Indiana 1890. The rise has been staggering in its speed. As recently as the 1970s, America's foreign-born population was under 5%. The country's gender dynamics are also in UX. Hillary Clinton was not just the RST female presidential candidate to win the popular vote but the RST to be nominated by a major political party. Women now make up 56% of college students, 6 and are 8 percentage points more likely than men to have earned a bachelor's degree by age 29.7 in 2018. For the RST time, Americans claiming no religion edged out Catholics and evangelicals to be the most popular response to the general social survey's question on religion. 8. Different ways of grouping religious sects will give you different perspectives on the decline of organized religion in America. The GSS, for instance, lists mainline Protestants and evangelical Protestants separately. But in the end of white Christian America, Robert Jones, the CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute, projects the religiously unaliated will edge out all Protestants in 2051, a thought that would have been unimaginable just a few decades ago. He writes. 9. These demographic categories interact in important ways. Jones, for instance, argues that the dominant culture in America has been white and Christian. Power, no less than oppression, is intersectional. Viewed through that lens, however, the tipping point has already happened. When Obama took OCE, 54% of the country was white and Christian. By the 2016 election, that had fallen to 43%. To put it even more starkly, about 7 out of every 10 seniors are white and Christian, compared with fewer than 3 in 10 young adults, a trend being driven not just by demographic change but by fewer young people identifying as Christian. These changes are big enough to feel, they're fast enough to feel, says Jones. 10 Demographers can and do disagree over whether these projections will hold in the future. Perhaps Hispanic whites will begin identifying simply as whites in the coming years, much as the Irish became white in the 20th century. Race is a construct, and we reconstruct its categories continuously. But that's only to say that it's often our perception of race and power that matters. And our perception of demographic change outpaces even the reality. In 2013, the Center for American Progress, PolicyLink, Latino Decisions, and the Rockefeller Foundation surveyed Americans and found that the median participant believed the country was 49% non-white. The correct answer was 37%. I spent months talking with politicians, social psychologists, and political scientists about what happens in moments like this one, moments when a majority feels its dominance beginning to fail. The answer, attested to in mountains of studies and visible everywhere in our politics, is this: change of this magnitude acts on us psychologically, not just electorally. It is the crucial context uniting the core political conists of this era, Obama's and Trump's presidencies, the rise of reactionary new social movements and thinkers, the wars over political correctness on campuses and representation in Hollywood, the power of number Me Too and Black Lives Matter, the GHTs over immigration. There is nothing that makes us identify with our groups so strongly as the feeling that the power we took for granted may soon be lost or the injustices we've long borne may soon be rectified. An identity is questioned only when it is menaced, wrote James Baldwin, as when the mighty begin to fall, or when the wretched begin to rise, or when the stranger enters the gates, never, thereafter, to be a stranger, the stranger's presence making you the stranger, less to the stranger than to yourself. 11 Demographic change, and the fears and hopes it evokes, is one of the tectonic forces shaping this era in American life. But to understand what it is doing to us as a country, we need to begin by understanding what it does to us as individuals. Change makes us conservative. In 2014, psychologists Maureen Craig and Jennifer Richeson analyzed the responses of 369 white self-identified political independents who had completed one of two surveys. 12 participants were randomly assigned to receive a survey that asked them whether they knew that California had become a majority-minority state, which is to say, a state where whites no longer made up more than 50% of the population, or a survey devoid of threatening demographic information. This was a gentle test of an unnerving theory, that the barest exposure to the concept that whites were losing their numerical majority in America would not just make whites feel afraid but sharply change their political behavior. The theory proved correct. Among participants who lived in the western United States, those who read that whites had ceded majority status were more than 13 points likelier to subsequently say they favored the Republican Party. In a follow-up study, Craig and Richeson handed some white subjects newspaper articles about geographic mobility, while others read a piece explaining that ethnic/racial minorities will comprise a majority of the U.S. populace by 2042. The group that read the racially tinged release shifted toward more conservative views, not just on directly related policy questions like immigration levels, affirmative actions, and paths to citizenship, but on healthcare reform and defense spending. I13 Perhaps the most striking experiment in this space was conducted by Harvard social scientist Ryan Enos. He attempted something rare in social science, an actual test of what seeing more diversity in our everyday surroundings does to our political opinions. His explanation of both the experiment and its results is worth reading. I sent Spanish speakers to randomly selected train stations in towns around Boston to simply catch the train and ride like any other passenger. I focused on stations in white suburbs. The intent was to create the impression, by subtle manipulation, that the Latino population in these segregated towns was increasing. Before and after sending these Spanish speakers to the train platforms, I surveyed passengers on the platforms about their attitudes about immigration. After being exposed to the Spanish speakers on their metro lines for just 3 days, attitudes on these questions moved sharply rightward. The mostly liberal Democratic passengers had come to endorse immigration policies including deportation of children of undocumented immigrants similar to those endorsed by Trump in his campaign. 14 So here, then, is what we know, even gentle, incidental exposure to reminders that America is diversifying and particularly to the idea that America is becoming a majority-minority nation pushes whites toward more conservative policy opinions and more support of the Republican Party. What happens when the exposure isn't so subtle? The post-racial myth. When Obama was elected in 2008, there was much talk of America moving into a post-racial moment. But as UC Irvine political scientist Michael Tesler shows in his powerful book Post-Racial or Most Racial, the mere existence of Obama's presidency further racialized American politics, splitting the two parties not just by racial composition but by racial attitudes. What Tesler proves is that in the Obama era, attitudes on race began shaping attitudes on virtually all political questions. The black-white divide in support for Obamacare was 20 percentage points larger than the black-white divide over Bill Clinton's similarly controversial health care proposal, for instance. But it wasn't just health care. Party identity Katyan became significantly more divided by race. Perceptions of the economy became significantly more divided by race. Even perceptions of the president's dogs became more divided by race. Shown pictures of the Obama's dog Bo, more racially resentful Americans liked the dog better when told it was a picture of Ted Kennedy's dog Splash. There's no doubt that there's some folks who just really dislike me because they don't like the idea of a black president, Obama told The New Yorker's David Remnick. Now, the IP side of it is there are some black folks and maybe some white folks who really like me and give me the benefit of the doubt precisely because I'm a black president. You might assume, seeing all this, that the reason for the racialization of American politics under Obama's presidency was that Obama, being African American, discussed racial issues and put forward race-conscious policies more often than past presidents. You'd be wrong. According to content analyses conducted by political and communication scientists, Barack Obama actually discussed race less in his RST term than any other Democratic president since Franklin Roosevelt, writes Tesler. 15. Obama's presidency didn't force race to the front of American politics through rhetoric or action. Rather, Obama himself was a symbol of a browning America, of white America's loss of control, of the fact that the country was changing and new groups were gaining power. That perception carried the force of fact. In his 2012 re-election campaign, Obama won merely 39% of the white vote, a smaller share than Michael Dukakis had commanded in 1988. A few decades ago, the multiracial Obama coalition couldn't elect a president. By 2012, it could. The changes that led to Obama's presidency are everywhere in our culture. We live in an America where television programs, commercials, and movies are trying to represent a browner country, where the BLM Black Panther is a celebrated cultural event and number Oscars So White is a nationally known hashtag, where NFL players kneel during the national anthem to protest police brutality and pressing one for English is commonplace. There's a reason why, when the Russians wanted to sow division in the American election, they focused their social media trolling on America's racial divisions. 16. White voters who feel they are losing a historical hold on power are reacting to something real. For the bulk of American history, you couldn't win the presidency without winning a majority, usually an overwhelming majority of the white vote. Though this changed before Obama, Bill Clinton won slightly less of the white vote than his Republican challengers. The election of an African American president leading a young, multiracial coalition made the transition stark and threatening. But this demographic transition is ongoing, not settled, and that makes the current moment particularly unstable. As Yale Law professor Amy Chua writes in Political Tribes, for 200 years, whites in America represented an undisputed politically, economically, and culturally dominant majority. When a political tribe is so overwhelmingly dominant, it can persecute with impunity, but it can also be more generous. It can afford to be more universalist, more enlightened, more inclusive, like the WASP elites of the 1960s who opened up the Ivy League colleges to more Jews, blacks, and other minorities in part because it seemed like the right thing to do. Today, no group in America feels comfortably dominant. Every group feels attacked, pitted against other groups, not just for jobs and spoils but for the right to deny the nation's identity. In these conditions, democracy devolves into zero-sum group competition, pure political tribalism. 17. Exacerbating this instability is an imbalance in who holds power where. A useful rule of thumb is that political power runs a decade behind demographics, with older, whiter, more Christian voters turning out at higher rates. The ballot box acts like a time machine, Robert Jones told me, taking us back 10 years in race and religion. We reached the tipping point of white Christians being a minority.